Hachette Audio presents The Wish, written by Nicholas Sparks, read by Mella Lee and Will Collier.
This is Nicholas Sparks, and I wanted to thank you for downloading the audio version of my latest novel, The Wish. It's a very special book to me as it combines two deep-seated passions of mine, a fascination with travel and my profound attachment to North Carolina, where all of my novels have been set. In the past 18 years, beginning with the around-the-world trip documented in my memoir, 3 Weeks with My Brother, I've had the privilege of traveling to some of the most remarkable places in the world, each unforgettable for its natural geography, rare cultural history, or astounding wildlife. However, the best part of any trip is coming home, and small-town North Carolina has been my beloved home for decades now. I never tire of its slow rhythms, its easygoing charm, and varied landscapes. On the first page of The Wish, you will meet Maggie Dawes, a New York-based travel photographer who's made a career of capturing images from every corner of the globe. But the origins of her extraordinary career lie in a summer when she was just 16 years old and found herself exiled to a tiny island off the coast of North Carolina in the off-season. Ocracoke Island is a tiny resort destination, windswept and beautiful, but quite isolated during the winter. Nonetheless, it is there, among the hardy island folk, that she finds not only the first love that marks her forever, but also family and a passion that will become her career. I'm attached to all of my novels for different reasons, but I do think this might be one of my best. You will cry, but hopefully you'll also laugh and come away deeply satisfied from this story of a woman trying to reconcile what might have been with the way things turned out for her. It's a challenge we all face as humans, to find and express love in the time and in the ways that our often unpredictable lives allow. Thank you again, and happy listening.
Dedication for Pam Pope and Oskara Stevic.
Tis the season. Manhattan, December 2019. Whenever December rolled around, Manhattan transformed itself into a city that Maggie didn't always recognize. Tourists thronged the shows on Broadway and flooded the sidewalks outside department stores in Midtown, forming a slow-moving river of pedestrians. Boutiques and restaurants overflowed with shoppers clutching bags, Christmas music filtered from hidden speakers, and hotel lobbies sparkled with decorations. The Rockefeller Center Christmas tree was lit by multicolored bulbs, and the flashes of thousands of iPhones and crosstown traffic, never speedy in the best of times, became so jammed up that it was often quicker to walk than to take a cab. But walking had its own challenges. Frigid wind frequently whipped between the buildings, necessitating thermal underwear, plentiful fleece, and jackets zipped to the collars. Maggie Dawes, who considered herself a free spirit consumed by wanderlust, had always loved the idea of a New York Christmas, albeit in a look-how-pretty postcard kind of way. In reality, like a lot of New Yorkers, she did her best to avoid Midtown during the holidays. Instead, she either stayed close to her home in Chelsea or, more commonly, fled to warmer climes. As a travel photographer, she sometimes thought of herself less as a New Yorker and more as a nomad who happened to have a permanent address in the city. In a notebook she kept in the drawer of her nightstand, she'd compiled a list of more than 100 places she still wanted to visit, some of them so obscure or remote that even reaching them would be a challenge. Since dropping out of college 20 years ago, she'd been adding to the list, noting places that sparked her imagination for one reason or another, even as her travels enabled her to cross out other destinations. With a camera slung over her shoulder, she'd visited every continent, more than 82 countries, and 43 of the 50 states. She'd taken tens of thousands of photographs, from images of wildlife in the Okavango Delta in Botswana to shots of the Aurora Borealis in Lapland. There were photographs taken as she'd hiked the Inca Trail, others from the Skeleton Coast in Namibia, still more among the ruins of Timbuktu. 12 years ago, she'd learned to scuba dive and had spent 10 days documenting marine life in Rasha Ampat. 4 years ago, she'd hiked to the famous Paro Taksang, or Tiger's Nest, a Buddhist monastery built into a cliffside in Bhutan, with panoramic views of the Himalayas. Others had often marveled at her adventures, but she'd learned that adventure is a word with many connotations, not all of them good. A case in point was the adventure she was on now. That's how she sometimes described it to her Instagram followers and YouTube subscribers, the one that kept her largely confined to either her gallery or her small two-bedroom apartment on West 19th Street, instead of venturing to more exotic locales. The same adventure that led to occasional thoughts of suicide. Oh, she'd never actually do it. The thought terrified her, and she'd admitted as much in one of the many videos she'd created for YouTube. For almost 10 years, her videos had been rather ordinary as far as photographers' posts went. She described her decision-making process when taking pictures, offered numerous Photoshop tutorials, and reviewed new cameras and their many accessories, usually posting 2 or 3 times a month. Those YouTube videos, in addition to her Instagram posts and Facebook pages and the blog on her website, had always been popular with photography geeks, while also burnishing her professional reputation. 3.5 years ago, however, on a whim, she'd posted a video to her YouTube channel about her recent diagnosis, one that had nothing to do with photography. The video, a rambling, unfiltered description of the fear and uncertainty she suddenly felt when she learned she had stage 4 melanoma, probably shouldn't have been posted at all. But what she imagined would be a lonely voice echoing back at her from the empty reaches of the internet somehow managed to catch the attention of others. She wasn't sure why or how, but that video, of all the ones she'd ever posted, had attracted a trickle, then a steady stream, and finally a deluge of views, comments, questions, and upvotes from people who had never heard of her or her work as a photographer. Feeling as though she had to respond to those who had been moved by her plight, she'd posted another video regarding her diagnosis that became even more popular. Since then, about once a month, she'd continued to post videos in the same vein, mainly because she felt she had no choice but to continue. In the past 3 years, she'd discussed various treatments and how they'd made her feel, sometimes even displaying the scars from her surgery. She talked about radiation burns, and nausea, and hair loss, and wondered openly about the meaning of life. She mused about her fear of dying and speculated on the possibility of an afterlife. They were serious issues, but maybe to stave off her own depression when discussing such a miserable subject, she did her best to keep the videos as light in tone as possible. She supposed that was part of the reason for their popularity, but who really knew? The only certainty was that somehow, almost reluctantly, she'd become the star of her own reality web series, one that had begun with hope, but had slowly narrowed to focus on a single, inevitable ending. And perhaps unsurprisingly, as the grand finale approached, her viewership exploded even more. In the first cancer video, that's how she mentally referred to them as opposed to her real videos, she stared into the camera with a wry grin and said, "Right off the bat, I hated it. Then it started growing on me." She knew it was probably in poor taste to joke about her illness, but the whole thing struck her as absurd. Why her? At the time, she was 36 years old, She exercised regularly, and she followed a reasonably healthy diet. There was no history of cancer in her family. She'd grown up in cloudy Seattle and lived in Manhattan, which ruled out a history of sunbathing. She'd never visited a tanning salon. None of it made any sense. But that was the point about cancer, wasn't it? Cancer didn't discriminate. It just happened to the unlucky. And after a while, she'd finally accepted that the better question was really, why not her? She wasn't special. To that point in her life, there'd been times when she considered herself interesting or intelligent or even pretty. But the word special had never entered her mind. When she'd received her diagnosis, she would have sworn she was in perfect health. A month earlier, she'd visited Vadu Island in the Maldives on a photo shoot for Condé Nast. She'd traveled there hoping to capture the bioluminescence just offshore that made ocean waves glow like starlight, as if lit from within. Sea plankton was responsible for the spectral, spectacular light, and she'd allotted extra time to shoot some images for personal use, perhaps for eventual sale in her gallery. She was scouting a mostly empty beach near her hotel in mid-afternoon with a camera in hand, trying to envision the shot she aimed to take once evening descended. She wanted to capture a hint of the shoreline, with perhaps a boulder in the foreground. The sky and, of course, the waves just as they were cresting. She'd spent more than an hour taking different shots from different angles and various locations on the beach when a couple strolled past her holding hands. Lost in her work, she barely registered their presence. A few moments later, while scanning the line where the waves were breaking offshore through her viewfinder, she heard the woman's voice behind her. She spoke English, but with a distinctly German accent.
"Excuse me," the woman said. "I can see that you're busy, and I am sorry to bother you."
Maggie lowered her camera. "Yes?"
"It's a little difficult to say this, but have you had that dark spot on the back of your shoulder examined?"
Maggie frowned, trying, without success, to see the spot between the straps of her bathing suit that the woman was referring to. "I didn't know I had a dark spot there." She squinted at the woman in confusion. "And why are you so interested?" The woman, 50-ish, with short gray hair, nodded.
"I should perhaps introduce myself. I'm Dr. Sabine Kessel," she said. "I'm a dermatologist in Munich. The spot looks abnormal."
Maggie blinked. "You mean like cancer?"
"I don't know," the woman said, her expression cautious. "But if I were you, I'd have it examined as soon as possible. It could be nothing, of course."
"Or it could be serious," Dr. Kessel didn't have to add. Though it took 5 nights to achieve what she wanted from the shoot, Maggie was pleased with the raw files. She would work on them extensively in digital post-production. The real art in photography these days almost always emerged in post. But she already knew the results would be spectacular. In the meantime, and though she tried not to worry about it, she also made an appointment with Dr. Snehal Khatri, a dermatologist on the Upper East Side, 4 days after her return to the city. The spot was biopsied in early July 2016, and afterward she was sent for additional testing. She had MRI and PET scans done at Memorial Sloan Kettering Hospital later that same month. After the results had come in, Dr. Khatri sat her down in the examination room, where he quietly and seriously informed her that she had stage 4 melanoma. Later that day, she was introduced to an oncologist named Leslie Brodigan, who would oversee her care. In the aftermath of these meetings, Maggie did her own research on the internet. Though Dr. Brodigan had told her that general statistics meant very little when it came to predicting outcomes for a particular individual, Maggie couldn't help fixating on the numbers. The survival rate after 5 years for those diagnosed with stage 4 melanoma, she learned, was less than 15%. In stunned disbelief, Maggie made her first cancer video the following day. At her second appointment,
Dr. Brodigan, a vibrant blue-eyed blonde who seemed to personify the term good health, explained everything about her condition again. Since the whole process had been so overwhelming that Maggie could remember only bits and pieces of their first meeting. Essentially, having stage 4 melanoma meant that the cancer had metastasized not only to the distant lymph nodes but to some of her other organs as well. In her case, both her liver and her stomach. The MRI and PET scans had found the cancerous growths invading healthier parts of her body, like an army of ants devouring food laid out on a picnic table. Long story short, the next 3.5 years were a blur of treatment and recovery, with occasional flashes of hope illuminating dark tunnels of anxiety. She had surgery to remove her infected lymph nodes and the metastases in her liver and stomach. The surgery was followed by radiation, which was excruciating, turning her skin black in places and leaving behind nasty scars to go with the ones she'd collected in the operating room. She also learned that there were different kinds of melanoma, even for those with stage 4, which led to different treatment options. In her case, that meant immunotherapy, which seemed to work for a couple of years, until it finally didn't. Then, last April, she had begun chemotherapy and continued it for months, hating how it made her feel, but convinced that it had to be effective. How could it not work, she wondered, since it seemed to be killing every other part of her? These days, she barely recognized herself in the mirror. Food nearly always tasted too bitter or too salty, which made it hard to eat, and she dropped more than 20 pounds from her already petite frame. Her oval-shaped brown eyes now appeared sunken and oversized above her protruding cheekbones, her face more like skin stretched over a skull. She was always cold and wore thick sweaters, even in her overheated apartment. She'd lost all of her dark brown hair, only to see it slowly grow back in patches, lighter in color and as fine as a baby's. She'd taken to wearing a kerchief or hat almost all the time. Her neck had become so spindly and fragile-looking that she wrapped it in a scarf to avoid glimpsing it in mirrors. A little more than a month ago, at the beginning of November, she had undergone another round of CAT and PET scans, and in December, she'd met again with Dr. Brodigan. The doctor had been more subdued than usual, although her eyes brimmed with compassion. There, she'd told Maggie that while more than 3 years of treatment had slowed the disease at times, its progression had never quite stopped. When Maggie asked what other treatment options were available, the doctor had gently turned her attention to the quality of life Maggie had remaining. It was her way of telling Maggie that she was going to die. Maggie had opened the gallery more than 9 years ago with another artist named Trinity, who used most of the space for his giant and eclectic sculptures. Trinity's real name was Fred Marshburn, and they'd met at an opening for another artist's show, the kind of event Maggie seldom attended. Trinity was already wildly successful at that point and had long toyed with the idea of opening his own gallery. He didn't, however, have any desire to actually manage the gallery, nor did he want to spend any time there. Because they'd hit it off, and because her photographs in no way competed with his work, they'd eventually made a deal. In exchange for her managing the business of the gallery, she would earn a modest salary and could also display a selection of her own work. At the time, it was more about prestige. She could tell people she had her own gallery than it was about the money Trinity paid her. In the first year or two, she sold only a few prints of her own. Because Maggie was still traveling extensively at the time, more than 100 days a year on average, the actual day-to-day running of the gallery fell to a woman named Luann Summers. When Maggie hired her, Luann was a wealthy divorcee with grown children. Her experience was limited to an amateur's passion for collecting and an expert's eye for finding bargains at Neiman Marcus. On the plus side, she dressed well. She was responsible, conscientious, and willing to learn. And she had no qualms about the fact that she'd earn little more than minimum wage.
As she put it, her alimony was enough to allow her to retire in luxury. But there were only so many lunches a woman could do without going crazy. Luann turned out to be a natural at sales. In the beginning, Maggie had briefed her on the technical elements of all of her prints, as well as the story behind each particular shot, which was often as interesting to buyers as the image itself. Trinity's sculptures, which utilized assorted materials, canvas, metal, plastic, glue, and paint, in addition to items collected from junkyards, deer antlers, pickle jars, and cans, were original enough to inspire spirited discussion. He was already an established critical darling, and his pieces moved regularly despite their staggering prices. But the gallery didn't advertise or feature many guest artists, so the work itself was fairly low-key. There were days when only a handful of people entered the premises, and they were able to close the gallery the last 3 weeks of the year. It was, for Maggie, Trinity, and Luann, an arrangement that worked well for a long time. But two things happened to change all that. First, Maggie's cancer videos lured new people to the gallery. Not the usual seasonal contemporary art or photography enthusiasts, but tourists from places like Tennessee and Ohio. People who'd begun to follow Maggie on Instagram and YouTube because they felt a connection to her. Some of them had become actual fans of her photography. But a lot of them simply wanted to meet her, or buy one of her signed prints as a keepsake. The phone began to ring off the hook with orders from random locations around the country, and additional orders poured in through the website. It was all Maggie and Luann could do to keep up, and last year, they'd made the decision to keep the gallery open through the holidays because the crowds kept coming. Then Maggie learned she'd soon have to begin chemotherapy, which meant she wouldn't be able to help at the gallery for months. It was clear that they needed to hire an additional employee, and when Maggie broached the subject with Trinity, he agreed on the spot. As fate would have it, the following day, a young man named Mark Price walked into the gallery and asked to speak with her, an event that at the time struck her as almost too good to be true. Mark Price was a recent college graduate who could have passed for a high schooler. Maggie initially assumed he was another cancer groupie, but she was only partially correct. He admitted he had become familiar with her work through her popular online presence. He was especially fond of her videos, he volunteered. But he'd also come in with a resume. He explained that he was looking for employment and the idea of working in the art world strongly appealed to him. Art and photography, he'd added, allowed for the communication of new ideas, often in ways that words did not. Despite her misgivings about hiring a fan, Maggie sat down with him the same day, and it became clear that he'd done his homework. He knew a great deal about Trinity and his work. He mentioned a specific installation that was currently on display at MoMA and another at the New School, drawing comparisons to some of Robert Rauschenberg's later work in a knowledgeable but unpretentious way. Though it didn't surprise her, he also had a deep and impressive familiarity with her own body of work. And yet, though he'd answered all her questions satisfactorily, she remained a little uneasy. She couldn't quite figure out whether he was serious about his desire to work in a gallery or just another person who wanted to witness her own tragedy up close. As their meeting drew to a close, she told him that they weren't currently interviewing. Though technically true, it was only a matter of time. To which he responded by asking politely whether she would nonetheless be willing to receive his resume. It was, she thought in retrospect, the way he'd phrased his request that charmed her.
"Would you nonetheless be willing to receive my resume?"
It struck her as old-fashioned and courtly, and she couldn't help smiling as she held out her hand for the document. Later that same week, Maggie had uploaded a job posting to some art-related industry sites and called several contacts at other galleries, letting them know she was hiring. Resumes and inquiries flooded the inbox, and Luann met with 6 candidates, while Maggie, either nauseated or vomiting from her first infusion, recuperated at home. Only one candidate made it past the first interview, but when she didn't show up for the second, she was scratched as well. Frustrated, Luann visited Maggie at home to update her. Maggie hadn't left her apartment in days and was lying on the couch, sipping the fruit and ice cream smoothie Luann had brought with her. One of the few things Maggie could still force down. "It's hard to believe we can't find anyone qualified to work in the gallery." Maggie shook her head. "They have no experience and don't know anything about art," Luann huffed. "Neither did you," Maggie could have pointed out. But she remained silent, fully aware that Luann had turned out to be a treasure as both a friend and an employee, the luckiest of breaks. Warm and unflappable, Luann had long ago ceased being a mere colleague. "I trust your judgment, Luann. We'll just start over. Are you sure there wasn't anyone else in the pool worth meeting?" Luann's tone was plaintive. For whatever reason, Maggie's mind flashed to Mark Price, inquiring ever so politely whether she would be willing to receive his resume. "You're smiling," Luann said. "No, I'm not." "I know a smile when I see one. What were you just thinking about?" Maggie took another sip of the smoothie, buying time, until finally deciding to come out with it. "A young man came in before we listed the position," she admitted, before proceeding to describe the meeting. "I'm still not sure about him," she concluded. "But his resume is probably somewhere on my desk in the office," she shrugged. "I don't know if he's even available at this point." When Luann probed the origins of Mark's interest in the job, she frowned. Luann understood the makeup of the gallery crowds better than anyone and recognized that people who'd seen Maggie's videos often viewed her as their confidant, someone who would both empathize and sympathize. They frequently longed to share their own stories, the suffering they had endured and the losses. And as much as Maggie wanted to offer them comfort, it was often too much to support them emotionally when she felt like she was barely holding it together herself. Luann did her best to shield her from the more aggressive contact seekers. "Let me review his resume and I'll speak with him," she said. "After that, we'll take it one step at a time." Luann contacted Mark the following week. Their first conversation led to two more formal interviews, including one with Trinity. When she later spoke with Maggie, her praise for Mark was effusive, but Maggie insisted on meeting with him again, just to be certain. It took four more days before she had the energy to make it to the gallery. Mark Price was on time, dressed in a suit and holding a slim binder as he stepped into her office. She felt sick as a dog as she studied his resume, noting that he was from Elkhart, Indiana. And when she saw his graduation date from Northwestern, she did a quick mental calculation. "You're 22 years old?"
"Yes."
With his neatly parted hair, blue eyes, and baby face, he looked like a well-groomed teenager ready for the prom. "And you majored in theology?"
"I did,"
he said. "Why theology?"
"My father is a pastor. Eventually, I want to get a master's in divinity as well, to follow in his footsteps."
As soon as he said it, she realized it didn't surprise her in the slightest. "Then why the interest in art if you intend to go into ministry?" He brought his fingertips together as though wanting to choose his words with care.
"I've always believed that art and faith have much in common. Both allow people to explore the subtlety of their own emotions and to find their own answers as to what the art represents to them. Your work and Trinity's always makes me think. And more importantly, they make me feel in ways that often lead to a sense of wonder. Just like faith."
It was a good answer, but she nonetheless suspected that Mark was leaving something out. Setting those thoughts aside, Maggie continued with the interview, asking more standard questions about his work history and knowledge of photography and contemporary sculpture before finally leaning back in her chair. "Why do you think you'd be a good fit for the gallery?" He seemed unfazed by her grilling.
For starters, having met Ms. Summers, I have the sense that she and I would work well together. With her permission, I spent some time in the gallery after our interview, and after a bit of additional research, I put together some of my thoughts about the work currently on display.
He leaned forward, offering her the binder.
I've left a copy with Ms. Summers as well.
Maggie thumbed through the binder. Stopping on a random page, she perused a couple of paragraphs he'd written concerning a photograph she'd taken in Djibouti in 2011, when the country was mired in one of the worst droughts in decades. In the foreground were the skeletal remains of a camel. In the background were three families dressed in brilliantly colorful garb, all of whom were laughing and smiling as they walked along a dried riverbed. Gathering storm clouds clotted a sky that had turned orange and red in the setting sun, a vivid contrast to the bleached bones of the skeleton and deep desiccation cracks that illustrated the lack of any recent rainfall. Mark's comments showed a surprising technical sophistication and a mature appreciation for her artistic intentions. She'd been trying to show an improbable joy amid despair, to illustrate man's insignificance when faced with the capricious power of nature, and Mark had articulated those intentions well. She closed the binder, knowing there was no need to look through the rest of it. "You clearly prepared, and considering your age, you seem surprisingly well qualified. But those aren't my major concerns. I still want to know the real reason you want to work here." His brow furrowed.
"I think your photographs are extraordinary, as are Trinity's sculptures."
"Is that all?"
"I'm not sure what you mean."
"I'll be frank," Maggie said, exhaling. She was too tired and too sick with too little time to be anything but frank. "You brought in your resume before we'd even posted that we were hiring, and you admitted you're a fan of my videos. Those things concern me because sometimes people who have watched my videos about my illness feel a false sense of intimacy with me. I can't have someone like that working here." She raised her eyebrows. "Are you imagining that we'll become friends and have deep and meaningful conversations? Because that's unlikely. I doubt I'll be spending much time at the gallery."
"I understand,"
he said, pleasant and unflustered.
"If I were you, I'd likely feel the same way. All I can do is assure you that my intention is to be an excellent employee."
She didn't make her decision right away. Instead, she slept on it and conferred with Luann and Trinity the following day. Despite Maggie's continuing uncertainty, they wanted to take a chance on him. And Mark started at the beginning of May. Fortunately, since then, Mark had given Maggie no reason to second-guess herself. With chemotherapy continuing to wipe her out all summer, she'd spent only a few hours a week at the gallery. But in the rare moments when she was there, Mark had been the consummate professional. He greeted her cheerfully, smiled easily, and always referred to her as Miss Dawes. He was never late for work, had never called in sick, and seldom disturbed her, knocking gently on her office door only when a bona fide buyer or collector had specifically asked for her and he deemed it important enough to intrude. Perhaps because he'd taken the interview to heart, he never referred to her recent video posts, nor did he ask her personal questions. Occasionally, he expressed the hope that she was feeling well, but that was okay with her, because he didn't actually inquire about it, leaving it up to her to say anything more if she wanted to. Moreover, and most importantly, he excelled at the job. He treated customers with courtesy and charm, moved the cancer groupies gracefully toward the exits, and excelled at sales, probably because he wasn't pushy in the slightest. He answered the phone, usually by the second or third ring, and carefully wrapped the prints before shipping those ordered by mail. Usually, to complete all of his tasks, he would stay for an hour or more after the gallery had closed its doors. Luann was so impressed by him that she had no worries about her month-long holiday in Maui with her daughter and grandchildren in December, a trip she'd taken almost every year since she'd started at the gallery. None of that, Maggie realized, had been much of a surprise,
What did surprise her was that, in the last few months, her reservations about Mark had slowly given way to a growing sense of trust. Maggie couldn't pinpoint exactly when that had happened. Like apartment neighbors regularly riding the same elevator, their cordial relationship settled into a comfortable familiarity. In September, once she began to feel better after her last infusion, she had started spending more time at work. Simple greetings with Mark gave way to small talk before segueing to more personal subjects. Sometimes those conversations took place in the small break room down the hall from her office. Other times in the gallery when it was devoid of visitors. Mostly they occurred after the doors had been locked, while the three of them processed and packaged the prints that had been ordered by phone or through the website. Usually Luann dominated the conversation, chattering about her ex-husband's poor dating choices, or her kids and grandkids. Maggie and Mark were content to listen. Luann was entertaining. Every now and then, one of them would roll their eyes at something Luann had said. "I'm sure my ex is paying for all the plastic surgery on that tacky gold digger." And the other would smile slightly. A private communication meant just for the two of them. Sometimes, though, Luann had to leave immediately after closing. Mark and Maggie would work together alone. And little by little, Maggie came to learn quite a bit about Mark, even as he refrained from asking personal questions of her. He told her about his parents and his childhood, which often struck her as something akin to an upbringing imagined by Norman Rockwell, complete with bedtime stories, hockey and baseball games, and his parents' attendance at every school event he could remember. He also spoke frequently about his girlfriend, Abigail, who'd just started working toward a master's degree in economics at the University of Chicago. Like Mark, she'd grown up in a small town, in her case, Waterloo, Iowa, and he had countless photographs of the two of them on his iPhone. The photos showed a pretty young redhead with a sunny Midwestern affect, and Mark mentioned that he planned to propose after she received her degree. Maggie could remember laughing when he said it. "Why get married when you're still so young?" she'd asked. "Why not wait a few years?" "Because," Mark had answered, "she's the one with whom I'd like to spend the rest of my life."
"How can you know that?"
"Sometimes you just know." The more she learned about him, the more she came to believe that his parents had been as lucky with him as he'd been with them. He was an exemplary young man, responsible and kind, disproving the stereotype that millennials were lazy and entitled. Still, her growing fondness for him sometimes surprised her, if only because they shared so little in common. Her early life had been unusual, at least for a time, and her relationship with her parents had often been strained. She herself had been nothing like Mark. While he'd been studious and had graduated with highest honors from a top university, she'd generally struggled in school and had finished less than 3 semesters at a community college. At his age, she had been content to live in the moment and figure things out on the fly, whereas he seemed to have a plan for everything. Had she met him when she was younger, she suspected that she wouldn't have given him the time of day. When she'd been in her 20s, she'd had a habit of choosing exactly the wrong kinds of men. Nonetheless, he sometimes reminded her of someone she'd known long ago, someone who had once meant everything to her. By the time Thanksgiving rolled around, Maggie considered Mark a definite member of the gallery family. She wasn't as close to him as she was to either Luann or Trinity. They'd spent years together, after all. But he'd become something akin to a friend, nonetheless. And 2 days after that holiday, all four of them had stayed late in the gallery after closing. It was Saturday night, and because Luann planned to fly to Maui the following morning while Trinity left for the Caribbean, they opened a bottle of wine to go with the cheese and fruit tray Luann had ordered. Maggie accepted a glass, even though she couldn't fathom the thought of either drinking or eating anything. They toasted the gallery,
It had been far and away their most successful year ever, and settled into easy conversation for another hour. Toward the end, Luann offered Maggie a card. "There's a gift inside," Luann said. "Open it after I'm gone." "I haven't had a chance to get yours yet." "That's fine," Luann said. "Seeing you back to your old self these past few months has been more than enough gift for me. Just make sure you open it well before Christmas, though." After Maggie assured her that she would, Luann stepped toward the platter and grabbed a couple of strawberries. A few feet away, Trinity was speaking to Mark. Because he visited the gallery even less frequently than Maggie did, she heard Trinity asking the same kinds of personal questions that she had over the last few months.
"I didn't know you played hockey," Trinity offered. "I'm a huge Islanders fan, even if they haven't won the Stanley Cup in what seems like forever."
"It's a great sport. I played every year until I got to Northwestern."
"Don't they have a team?"
"I wasn't good enough to play at the collegiate level,"
Mark admitted.
"Not that it seemed to matter to my parents. I don't think either of them ever missed a game."
"Will they come out to see you for Christmas?"
"No,"
Mark said.
"My dad set up a tour of the Holy Land with a couple dozen members of our church for the holidays. Nazareth, Bethlehem, the whole works."
"And you didn't want to go?"
"It's their dream, not mine. Besides, I have to be here."
Maggie saw Trinity glance in her direction before he turned his attention back to Mark. He leaned in, whispering something. And though Maggie couldn't hear him, she knew exactly what Trinity had said because he'd expressed his own concerns to her a few minutes earlier.
"Make sure you keep an eye on Maggie while Luann and I are gone. We're both a little worried about her."
In response, Mark simply nodded. Trinity was more prescient than he probably realized. But then again, both Trinity and Luann had known that Maggie had another appointment with Dr. Brodigan scheduled on December 10th. And sure enough, at that appointment, Dr. Brodigan had urged Maggie to focus on her quality of life. Now it was December 18th. More than a week had passed since that awful day, and Maggie still felt almost numb. Nor had she told anyone about her prognosis. Her parents had always believed that if they prayed hard enough, God would somehow heal her, and telling them the truth would take more energy than she could summon. Same thing in a different way with her sister. Long story short, she didn't have the energy. Mark had texted a couple of times to check in on her, but saying anything about her situation via text struck her as absurd, and she hadn't been ready to face anyone just yet. As for Luann or even Trinity, she supposed she could call them, but what would be the point? Luann deserved to enjoy the time she was spending with her own family without worrying about Maggie, and Trinity had his own life as well. Besides, there was nothing that either of them could really do. Instead, dazed by her new reality, she'd spent much of the last 8 days either in her apartment or on short, slow walks through her neighborhood. Sometimes, she simply stared out the window, absently fondling the small pendant on the necklace she always wore. Other times, she found herself people-watching. When she'd first moved to New York, she had been enthralled by the ceaseless activity around her, by seeing people rushing down into the subway or peering up into office towers at midnight with the knowledge that people were still at their desks. Following the hectic movements of pedestrians below her window brought back memories of her early adulthood in the city and the younger, healthier woman she had once been. It seemed like a lifetime had passed since then. It also felt as though the years had passed in the blink of an eye, and her inability to grasp that contradiction made her more self-reflective than usual. Time, she thought, would always be elusive. She hadn't expected the miraculous deep down. She'd always known a cure was out of the question. But wouldn't it have been great to learn that the chemotherapy had slowed the cancer a little and brought her an extra year or two? Or that some experimental treatment had become available? Would that have been too much to ask? to have been given one last intermission before the final act began. That was the thing about battling cancer. The waiting. So much of the last few years had been about waiting. Waiting for the appointment with the doctor. Waiting for the treatment. Waiting to feel better after the treatment. Waiting to see whether the treatment had worked. Waiting until she was well enough to try something new. Until her diagnosis, she'd viewed waiting for anything as an irritation. But waiting had slowly but surely become the defining reality of her life. Even now, she suddenly thought, here I am, waiting to die. On the sidewalk beyond the glass, she saw people bundled up in winter gear, their breath making clouds of steam as they hurried to unknown destinations. On the street, a long line of cars with glowing taillights crawled through narrow lanes lined by pretty brick townhouses. They were people going about their daily lives as though nothing out of the ordinary were happening. But nothing felt ordinary now, and she doubted things would ever feel ordinary again. She envied them, these strangers she would never meet. They were living their lives without counting the days they had left. Something she would never do again. And as always, there were so many of them. She'd grown used to the fact that everything in the city was always crowded, no matter the time or the season, which added inconvenience to even the simplest things. If she needed ibuprofen from Duane Reade, there was a line to check out. If she was in the mood to see a movie, there was a line at the box office, too. When it came time to cross the street, she was inevitably surrounded by others, people rushing and jostling at the curb. But why the rush? She wondered about that now, just as she wondered about so many things. Like everyone, she had regrets, and now that time was running out, she couldn't help dwelling on them. There were actions she'd taken that she wished she could undo. There were opportunities she'd missed and now would never have the time to do. She'd spoken honestly about some of her regrets in one of her videos, admitted to feeling unreconciled to them, and no closer to answers than when she'd initially been diagnosed. Nor had she cried since her last meeting with Dr. Brodigan. Instead, when she wasn't staring out the window or taking her walks, she'd focused on the mundane. She'd slept and slept, averaging 14 hours a night, and had ordered Christmas gifts online. She'd recorded but hadn't yet posted another cancer video concerning her last appointment with Dr. Brodigan. She'd had smoothies delivered and tried to finish them as she sat in the living room. Recently, she'd even tried to have lunch at Union Square Cafe. It had always been one of her favorite places to grab a delicious meal at the bar, but the visit ended up being a waste, since everything that crossed her lips still tasted wrong. Cancer taking yet another joy from her life. Now it was a week until Christmas, and with the afternoon sun beginning to wane, she felt the need to get out of the apartment. She dressed in multiple layers, assuming she would stroll aimlessly for a bit, but once she stepped outside, the mood to simply wander passed as quickly as it had come. Instead, she started toward the gallery. Though she wouldn't do much work, it would be comforting to know that all was in order. The gallery was several blocks away, and she moved slowly, trying to avoid anyone who might bump into her. The wind was icy, and by the time she pushed through the doors of the gallery a half hour before closing, she was shivering. It was unusually crowded. She'd expected that the holidays would diminish the number of visitors, but clearly she'd been wrong about that. Luckily, Mark seemed to have things under control. As always, when she entered, heads turned in her direction, and she noted dawning looks of recognition on some faces. "Sorry, not today, folks," she suddenly thought, offering a quick wave before hurrying to her office. She shut the door behind her. Inside, there was a desk and an office chair, and one of the walls featured built-in bookcases, piled high with photography books and keepsakes from her far-flung travels. Across from the desk was a small gray love seat, just big enough to curl up on if she needed to lie down. In the corner stood an ornately carved rocker with flowered cushions that Luann had brought from her country house, lending a touch of warmth to the modern office. After piling her gloves, hat, and jacket on the desk, Maggie readjusted her kerchief and collapsed into her office chair. Turning on the computer, she automatically checked the weekly sales figures, noting the spike in volume, but realized she wasn't in the mood to study the numbers in detail. Instead, she opened another folder and began clicking through her favorite photos, finally pausing at a series of images she'd taken in Ulaanbaatar, Mongolia, last January. At the time, she'd had no idea it would be the last international trip she would ever take. The temperature had been well below zero the entire time she was there, with biting winds that could freeze exposed skin in less than a minute. It had been an effort to keep her camera working because the components grew finicky in temperatures that low. She could remember repeatedly tucking the camera inside her jacket to warm it against her body. But the photographs were so important to her. She'd braved the elements for almost 2 hours. She'd wanted to find ways to document the poisonous levels of air pollution and its visible effects on the population. In a city of 1.5 million people, nearly every home and business burned coal throughout the winter, darkening the sky even in brightest daylight. It was a health crisis as well as an environmental one, and she'd wanted her images to spur people to action. She'd logged countless photographs of children covered in grime as a result of stepping outside to play. She'd caught an amazing black and white image of filthy cloth that had been used as drapery for an open window, dramatizing what was happening inside otherwise healthy lungs. She'd also sought out a stark panorama of the city and finally nailed the image she wanted. A brilliant blue sky that suddenly, immediately gave way to a pale, almost sickly yellow haze, as though God himself had drawn a perfectly straight line dividing the sky in two. The effect was utterly arresting, especially after the hours she'd spent refining it in post. As she stared at the image in the solace of her office, she knew she would never be able to do something like that again. She would likely never travel for work again. She might never even leave Manhattan unless she gave in to her parents and returned to Seattle. Nor had anything in Mongolia changed. In addition to the photo essay that she'd contributed to The New Yorker, a number of media outlets, including Scientific American and The Atlantic, had also tried to raise awareness regarding the dangerous levels of pollution in Ulaanbaatar. But the air, if anything, had grown even worse in the last 11 months. It was, she thought, yet another failure in her life, just like her battle with cancer. The thoughts shouldn't have been connected, but in that instant they were, and all at once she felt tears begin to form. She was dying. She was actually dying, and it dawned on her suddenly that she was about to experience her very last Christmas. What should she be doing with these last precious weeks? And what did quality of life even mean when it came to the actuality of day-to-day living? She was already sleeping more than ever, but did quality mean getting more sleep to feel better, or less sleep so the days seemed longer? And what about her routines? Should she bother making an appointment to have her teeth cleaned? Should she pay off the minimum balance on her credit cards or go on a spending spree? Because what did it matter? What did anything really matter? 100 random thoughts and questions overran her. Lost in all of it, she felt herself choke before letting go completely. She didn't know how long the outburst lasted. Time slipped away. When she was finally spent, she stood and swiped at her eyes. Glancing through the one-way window above her desk, she noticed that the gallery floor was empty and that the front door had been locked. Strangely, she didn't see Mark, even though the lights were still on. She wondered where he was until she heard a knock at the door. Even his knock was gentle. She considered making an excuse until the evidence of her breakdown had subsided, but why bother? She'd long since stopped caring about her appearance. She knew she looked awful even at the best of times. "Come on in," she said, pulling a Kleenex from the box on her desk. She blew her nose as Mark stepped through the door.
"Hey,"
he said, his voice quiet.
"Hi."
"Bedtime?"
"It's all right."
"I thought you might like this,"
he said, holding out a to-go cup.
"It's a banana and strawberry smoothie with vanilla ice cream. Maybe it'll help."
She recognized the label on the cup. The eatery was two doors down from the gallery and wondered how he'd known how she was feeling. Perhaps he'd divined something when she'd made a beeline for her office. Or maybe he'd simply remembered what Trinity had told him.
"Thank you," she said, taking it.
"Are you okay?"
"I've been better."
She took a sip, thankful it was sweet enough to override her messed up taste buds.
"How was it today?"
"Busy, but not as bad as last Friday. We sold 8 prints, including a number 3 of Rush."
Each of her photographs was limited to 25 numbered prints. The lower the number, the higher the price. The photo Mark mentioned had been taken at rush hour in the Tokyo subway, the platform jammed with thousands of men dressed in what seemed to be identical black suits.
"Anything by Trinity?"
"Not today, but I think there's a good possibility of that in the near future. Jackie Bernstein came in with her consultant earlier."
Maggie nodded. Jackie had bought 2 other Trinity pieces in the past, and Trinity would be pleased to know she was interested in another.
"How about on the website and phone-ins?"
6 confirmed, 2 people wanted more information. It shouldn't take long to get the sales ready for shipment. If you want to head on home, I can handle it."
As soon as he said it, her mind floated additional questions. Do I truly want to go home? To an otherwise empty apartment, to wallow in solitude?
"No, I'll stay,"
she demurred, shaking her head.
"For a while, anyway."
She sensed his curiosity but knew he wouldn't ask more. Again, she understood the interviews had left a lingering mark.
"I'm sure you've been following my social posts and videos," she began, "so you probably have a general sense of what's going on with my illness."
"Not really. I haven't watched any of your videos since I began working here."
She hadn't expected that. Even Luann watched her videos.
"Why not?"
"I assumed you would prefer that I didn't. And when I considered your initial concerns about my working here, it seemed like the right thing to do."
"But you did know I underwent chemotherapy, right?"
"Luann mentioned it, but I don't know the details. And of course, in the rare times you were at the gallery, you looked..."
When he trailed off, she finished for him.
"Like death?"
"I was going to say you looked a bit tired."
"Sure I did. If gaunt, green, shrinking, and balding could be explained by waking up too early." But she knew he was trying to be kind.
"Do you have a few minutes before you start getting the shipments ready?"
"Of course. I don't have anything planned for tonight."
On an impulse, she moved to the rocker, motioning for him to get comfortable on the love seat.
"No going out with friends?"
"It's kind of expensive,"
he said.
"And going out usually means drinking, but I don't drink."
"Ever?"
"No."
"Wow," she said. "I don't think I've ever met a 22-year-old who's never had a drink."
"Actually, I'm 23 now."
"You had a birthday?"
"It wasn't a big deal."
"Probably not," she thought. "Did Luann know? She didn't say anything to me."
"I didn't mention it to her."
She leaned forward and raised her cup.
"Happy belated birthday, then."
"Thank you."
"Did you do anything fun? For your birthday, I mean?"
"Abigail flew out for the weekend, and we saw Hamilton. Have you seen it?"
"A while ago. But I won't ever see it again," she didn't bother to add,
which was another reason not to be alone, so that thoughts like those didn't precipitate yet another breakdown.
With Mark here, it was somehow easier to keep herself together.
I'd never seen a show on Broadway before,
Mark went on.
The music was amazing, and I loved the historical element and the dancing and everything about it. Abigail was electrified. She swore she'd never experienced anything like it.
How is Abigail?
She's doing well. Her break just started, so she's probably on her way to Waterloo right now to see her family.
She didn't want to come out here to see you?
It's sort of a mini family reunion. Unlike me, she has a big family. 5 older brothers and sisters who live all over the country. Christmas is the only time of year they can all get together.
And you didn't want to go out there?
I'm working. She understands that. Besides, she's coming out here on the 28th. We'll spend some time together, watch the ball drop on New Year's Eve, things like that.
Will I get to meet her?
If you'd like.
If you need time off, let me know. I'm sure I can manage on my own for a couple of days.
She wasn't sure she could, but it felt like she needed to offer.
I'll let you know.
Maggie took another sip of her smoothie. I don't know if I've mentioned it lately, but you're doing really well here.
I enjoy it,
he said. He waited, and she knew again that he'd made a choice not to ask personal questions, which meant she would have to volunteer the information or keep it to herself. I met with my oncologist last week, she stated in what she hoped was an even voice. She thinks another round of chemotherapy will do more harm than good. His expression softened.
Can I ask what that means?
It means no more treatment. And the clock is ticking. He paled, registering what she hadn't said.
Oh, Ms. Dawes, that's terrible. I'm so sorry. I don't know what to say. Is there anything I can do?
I don't think there's anything anyone can do. But please call me Maggie. I think you've worked here long enough for the two of us to use first names.
Is the doctor certain?
The scans weren't good, she said. Lots of spread everywhere. Stomach, pancreas, kidneys, lungs. And though you won't ask, I have less than 6 months. Most likely it's somewhere around 3 to 4. Maybe even less. Surprising her, his eyes began to well with tears.
Oh, Lord,
he said with his expression suddenly softening.
Would you mind if I pray for you? Not now, but when I get home, I mean.
She couldn't help smiling. Of course he would want to pray for her, future pastor that he was. She suspected he'd never uttered a profanity in his life. He was, she thought, a very sweet kid. Well, technically he was a young man, but I'd like that. For a few seconds, neither of them said anything. Then, with a soft shake of his head, he pressed his lips together.
It isn't fair,
he said. When is life ever fair?
Can I ask how you're doing? I hope you forgive me if I'm overstepping.
It's okay, she said. I guess I've been in a bit of a daze since I found out.
It has to feel unbearable.
At times it does. But then other times it doesn't. The strange thing is that physically I feel better than I did earlier in the year, during the chemo. Back then there were times when I was sure dying would be easier. But now... She let her gaze wander over the shelves, noting the trinkets she'd collected. Each one imbued with memories of a trip she'd taken. To Greece and Egypt. Rwanda and Nova Scotia, Patagonia and Easter Island, Vietnam and the Ivory Coast. So many places. So many adventures. It's a strange thing to know the end is so imminent, she admitted. It gives a rise to a lot of questions. Makes a person wonder what it's all about. Sometimes I feel that I've led a charmed life, but then in the next instant, I find myself obsessing over the things I've missed out on.
Like what?
Marriage, for starters, she said. You know I've never been married, right? When he nodded, she went on. Growing up, I couldn't imagine that I'd still be single at my age. Just wasn't the way I was raised. My parents were very traditional, and I assumed I'd end up like them. She felt her thoughts drifting to the past, memories bubbling to the surface. Of course, I didn't make it easy for them. Not like you, anyway.
I wasn't always a perfect child,
he protested.
I got in trouble.
For what? Anything serious? Was it because you didn't clean your room or because you were a minute late for your curfew? Oh, wait. You were never late for your curfew, right? He opened his mouth, but when no words came out, she knew she was right. He must have been the kind of teenager who made things harder for the rest of his generation, simply because he was wired to be easy. The point is, I've been wondering how things would have turned out if I'd chosen a different path. Not just marriage, though. What if I'd worked harder in school, or graduated from college, or had a job in an office, or moved to Miami or Los Angeles instead of New York? Things like that.
You obviously didn't need college. Your career as a photographer has been remarkable, and your videos and posts about your illness have inspired a lot of people.
That's very kind. But they don't really know me. And in the end, isn't that the most important thing in life? To be truly known and loved by someone you've chosen?
Maybe.
He conceded.
But that doesn't negate what you've given people through your experience. It's a powerful act, even life-changing for some.
Perhaps it was his sincerity, or his old-fashioned mannerisms. But she was struck again by how much he reminded her of someone she'd once known long ago. She hadn't thought about Bryce in years, not consciously anyway. For most of her adult life, she'd tried to keep her memories of him at a safe distance. But there was no reason to do that any longer. "Would you mind if I asked you a personal question?" she said, mirroring his curiously formal style of speech.
"Not at all."
"When did you first know that you were in love with Abigail?" As soon as she said Abigail's name, a tenderness came over him.
"Last year,"
he said, leaning back into the cushions of the love seat.
"Not long after I graduated. We'd gone out 4 or 5 times, and she wanted me to meet her parents. Anyway, we were driving to Waterloo, just the two of us. We'd stopped for something to eat, and on the way out, she decided she wanted an ice cream cone. It was scorching outside, and unfortunately, the air conditioning in the car wasn't working that well, so of course it started to melt all over her. A lot of people might have been upset by that, but she just started giggling like it was the funniest thing ever as she tried to eat it faster than it could melt. There was ice cream everywhere, on her nose and fingers, in her lap, even in her hair. And I remember thinking that I wanted to be around someone like that forever. Someone who could laugh at the inconveniences of life and find joy in any occasion. That's when I knew she was the one."
"Did you tell her then?"
"Oh, no. I wasn't brave enough. It took me until last fall before I could finally work up the courage to tell her."
"Did she say that she loved you too?"
"She did. That was a relief."
"She sounds like a wonderful person."
"She is. I'm very lucky."
Though he smiled, she knew he was still troubled.
"I wish there was something I could do for you,"
he said, his voice soft. "Working here is enough. Well, that and staying late."
"I'm glad to be here. I wonder, though..."
"Go ahead," she said, gesturing with the smoothie. "You can ask whatever question you'd like. I've got nothing to hide anymore."
"Why didn't you ever get married? If you thought you would, I mean."
"There were a lot of reasons. When I was just starting out in my career, I wanted to concentrate on that until I established a foothold. And then I started traveling a lot, and then came the gallery, and I guess I was just too busy."
"And you never met someone who made you question all that?"
In the silence that followed, she unconsciously reached for the necklace, feeling for the small shell-shaped pendant, making sure it was still there. I thought I did. I know I loved him, but the timing wasn't right.
Because of work?
No, she said. It happened long before then. But I'm pretty sure I wouldn't have been good for him. Not back then, anyway.
I can't believe that.
You don't know who I used to be. She put down her cup and folded her hands in her lap. Do you want to hear the story?
I'd be honored.
It's kind of long.
Those are usually the best kind of stories.
Maggie bent her head, feeling the images begin to surface at the edge of her mind. With the images, the words would eventually come, she knew. In 1995, when I was 16 years old, I began to lead a secret life, she started. Marooned, Ocracoke, 1995. Actually, when I'm being honest, my secret life really began when I was 15, and my mom found me on the bathroom floor, green in the gills, with my arms wrapped around the toilet bowl. I'd been barfing every morning for the past week and a half, and my mom, more knowledgeable about such things than I was, raced to the drugstore and made me pee on a stick as soon as she got home. When the blue plus sign appeared, she stared at the stick for a long time without saying a single word, then retreated to the kitchen, where she cried on and off for the rest of the day. That was in early October, and I was a little more than 9 weeks along by then. I probably cried as much as my mom that day. I stayed in my room clutching my favorite teddy bear. I'm not sure my mom even noticed that I hadn't gone to school, and stared out the window with swollen eyes, watching buckets of rain pour onto foggy streets. It was typical Seattle weather, and even now I doubt there's a more depressing place to be in the entire world, especially when you're 15 and pregnant, and certain your life is over before it even had a chance to begin. It went without saying that I had no idea what I was going to do. That's what I remember most of all. I mean, what did I know about being a parent, or even being a grown-up? Oh, sure, there were times when I felt older than my age, like when Zeke Watkins, the star player of the varsity basketball team, spoke to me in the school parking lot. But part of me still felt like a kid. I loved Disney movies and celebrating with strawberry ice cream cake at the roller rink on my birthday. I always slept with a teddy bear and I couldn't even drive. Frankly, I wasn't even all that experienced when it came to the opposite sex. I'd only kissed 4 boys in my entire life. But one time, the kissing went too far, and a little more than 3 weeks after that awful, barfing, and tear-filled day, my parents shipped me off to Ocracoke in the Outer Banks of North Carolina, a place I didn't even know existed. It was supposedly a picturesque beach town adored by tourists. There, I would live with my Aunt Linda Dawes, my father's much older sister, a woman I'd met only once in my life. They'd also made arrangements with my teachers so I wouldn't fall behind in my studies. My parents had a long discussion with the headmaster, and after the headmaster spoke to my aunt, he decided to trust her to proctor my exams, making sure I didn't cheat and that all my assignments were turned in. And just like that, I suddenly became the family secret. My parents didn't come with me to North Carolina, which made leaving that much harder. Instead, we said our goodbyes at the airport on a chilly November morning a few days after Halloween. I'd just turned 16. I was 13 weeks along and terrified. But I didn't cry on the plane, thank God. Nor did I cry when my aunt picked me up at a rinky-dink airport in the middle of nowhere. Or even when we checked into a dumpy motel near the beach, since we had to wait to catch the ferry to Ocracoke the following morning. By then, I'd almost convinced myself that I wasn't going to cry at all. Boy, was I ever wrong. After we disembarked from the ferry, my aunt gave me a quick tour of the village before bringing me to her house. And to my dismay, Ocracoke was nothing like I'd imagined. I guess I'd been picturing pretty pastel cottages nestled in the sand dunes, with tropical views of the ocean stretching to the horizon. A boardwalk complete with burger joints and ice cream shops, and crowded with teens, maybe even a Ferris wheel or a carousel. But Ocracoke was nothing like that. Once you got past the fishing boats in the tiny harbor where the ferry dropped us off, it looked ugly. The houses were old and weather-beaten. There wasn't a beach, boardwalk, or palm tree in sight. And the village, that's what my aunt called it, a village, seemed utterly deserted. My aunt mentioned that Ocracoke was essentially a fishing village and that less than 800 people lived there year-round. But I could only wonder why anyone would want to live there at all. Aunt Linda's place was right on the water, sandwiched between homes that were equally run down. It was set on stilts with a view of the Pamlico Sound, with a compact front porch, and another larger porch off the living room that faced the water. It was also small, living room with a fireplace and a window near the front door, dining area and kitchen, two bedrooms and a single bath. There wasn't a television in sight, which left me feeling suddenly panicked, though I don't think she realized it. She showed me around and eventually pointed out where I would be sleeping, across the hall from her room in what usually served as her reading room. My first thought was that it was nothing like my bedroom back home. It wasn't even like half my bedroom back home. There was a twin bed wedged beneath a window along with a padded rocking chair, a reading lamp, and a shelf crammed with books by Betty Friedan, Sylvia Plath, Ursula K. Le Guin, and Elizabeth Berg, in addition to tomes on Catholicism, St. Thomas Aquinas, and Mother Teresa. Again, no television. But there was a radio, even if it looked 100 years old, and an old-fashioned clock. The closet, if you could call it that, was barely a foot deep, and the only way I would be able to store my clothes was to fold and stack them in vertical piles on the floor. There was no nightstand or chest of drawers, all of which made me suddenly feel like I was visiting unexpectedly for a single night, rather than the 6 months intended. "I love this room," my aunt said with a sigh, setting my suitcase on the floor. "It's so comfortable." "It's nice," I forced out. After she left me alone to unpack, I plopped down on the bed, still in disbelief that I was actually here. At this house, in this place, with this relative. I stared out the window, noting the rust-colored wooden planking on the neighbor's house, wishing with every blink that I'd be able to see Puget Sound, or the snow-capped Cascade Mountains, or even the rocky and rugged coast I'd known all my life. I thought about the Douglas fir and red cedar trees, and even the fog and rain. I thought about my family and friends, who might as well have been on another planet, and the lump in my throat grew even bigger. I was pregnant and alone, marooned in a terrible place, and all I wanted was to turn back the clock and change what had happened. All of it. The oops, the barfing, the withdrawal from school, the trip here. I wanted to be a regular teenager again. Hell, I would have taken being just a kid again instead of this. But I suddenly remembered the blue plus sign on the pregnancy test, and the pressure began to build behind my eyes. I may have been strong on the journey, and maybe even up until then. But when I squeezed my teddy bear to my chest and inhaled her familiar scent, the dam simply burst. It wasn't a pretty cry like you see in Hallmark movies. It was a raging sob, complete with snorts and wails and quivering shoulders, and it seemed to go on forever. About my teddy bear. She was neither cute nor expensive, but I'd slept with her for as long as I could remember. The thin, coffee-colored fur had worn away in patches, and Frankenstein's stitches held one of her arms in place. I'd had my mom sew on a button when one of her eyes had popped off, but the damage made her seem even more special to me, because sometimes I felt damaged, too. In third grade, I'd used a Sharpie to write my name on the bottom of her foot, marking her as mine forever. When I was younger, I used to bring her with me everywhere, my own version of a security blanket. Once I'd accidentally left her at a Chuck E. Cheese when I'd gone to a friend's birthday party, and when I got home, I cried so hard I actually puked. My dad had to drive back across town to retrieve her, and I'm pretty sure I held on to her for almost a week straight after that. Over the years, she had been dropped in mud, splashed with spaghetti sauce, and soaked with sleep drool. Whenever my mom decided it was finally time to wash her, she'd throw her in the laundry along with my clothes. I'd sit on the floor watching the washer and dryer, imagining her tumbling among the jeans and towels, and hoping she wouldn't be destroyed in the process. But Maggie Bear, short for Maggie's Bear, would eventually emerge clean and warm. My mom would hand her back to me and I'd suddenly feel complete again, like all was right in the world. When I went to Ocracoke, Maggie Bear was the only thing I knew I couldn't leave behind. Aunt Linda checked on me during my breakdown but didn't seem to know what to say or do, and apparently she decided it was probably best to let me sort through things on my own. I was glad about that, but kind of sad too because it made me feel even more isolated than I already did. Somehow, I survived that first day. Then the next. She showed me a bicycle she'd bought at a garage sale which looked older than I was, with a cushy seat big enough for someone twice my size and a basket on the front hanging from massive handlebars. I hadn't ridden a bike in years.
I had a young man in town fix it up, so it should work fine.
Great, was all I could muster. On the third day, my aunt went back to work and was out of the house long before I finally woke. On the table, she'd left a folder filled with my homework, and I realized that I was already falling behind. I hadn't been a great student even in the best of times. I was middle of the pack and hated when my report cards came out. And if I hadn't cared much about acing my classes before, I was even more apathetic now. She'd also written me a note to remind me that I had two quizzes the following day. Even though I tried to study, I couldn't concentrate and already knew I was going to bomb them, which I promptly did. Afterward, maybe because she was feeling even more sorry for me than usual, my aunt thought it might be a good idea to get me out of the house and drove me to her shop. It was a small eatery and coffee bar that offered a lot more than just food. It specialized in biscuits that were baked fresh every morning and served either with sausage gravy or as some sort of sandwich or dessert. Beyond breakfast, the shop also sold used books and rented out video cassettes, shipped UPS packages, had mailboxes for rent, offered faxes, scanning, and copies, and provided Western Union services. My aunt owned the place with her friend Gwen, and it opened at 5 in the morning so the fishermen could grab a bite before heading out, which meant she was usually there by 4 to start baking. She introduced me to Gwen, who wore an apron over jeans and a flannel shirt and kept her graying blonde hair in a messy ponytail. She seemed nice enough, and though I only spent about an hour in the shop, my impression was that they treated each other like an old married couple. They could communicate with a single glance, predicted each other's requests, and moved around each other behind the counter like dancers. Business was steady but not booming, and I spent most of my time thumbing through the used books. There were Agatha Christie mysteries, westerns by Louis L'Amour, along with a good-sized selection of books by best-selling authors. There was also a donation box. And while I was there, a woman who'd come in for coffee and a biscuit dropped off a small crate of books, almost all of them romance novels. As I riffled through them, I thought to myself that if I'd had less romance in August, I wouldn't be in the mess I was in right now. The shop closed at 3 during the week, and after Gwen and Aunt Linda locked the doors, my aunt took me on a longer, more extensive tour of the village. It took all of 15 minutes, and didn't change my initial impression in the slightest. After that, we went home, where I hid out in my room for the rest of the day. As weird as the room was, it was the only place I had some privacy when Aunt Linda was home. When I wasn't half-assing my way through my schoolwork, I could listen to music, brood, and spend way too much time contemplating death and my growing belief that the world, and especially my family, would be better off without me. I wasn't quite sure what to make of my aunt, either. She had short gray hair and warm hazel eyes, set in a face deeply lined with wrinkles. Her gait was always hurried. She'd never been married, never had children, and sometimes came across as a little bit bossy. She also used to be a nun, and even though she'd left the Sisters of Mercy almost 10 years ago, she still believed in the whole cleanliness is next to godliness thing. I had to straighten up my room daily, do my own laundry, and clean the kitchen before she got home in mid-afternoon as well as after dinner. Fair enough, I suppose, since I was living there. But no matter how hard I tried, I never seemed to do it right. Our conversations about it were usually short. A statement followed by an apology, like this. The cups were still damp when you put them back in the cupboard.
Sorry.
There are still crumbs on the table.
Sorry.
You forgot to use 409 when you cleaned the stovetop.
Sorry.
You need to straighten the covers on your bed.
Sorry.
I must have said sorry 100 times the first week I was there, and the second week was even worse. I bombed yet another test and grew bored by the view when I sat on the porch. I eventually came to believe that even if you stuck someone on a fabulous tropical island, the sight would get old after a while. I mean, the ocean never seems to change. Whenever you see it, the water is just there. Sure, the clouds might shift around, and right before sunset, the sky might glow orange and red and yellow. But what fun is watching a sunset if there's no one to share it with? My aunt wasn't the kind of woman who seemed to appreciate such things. And by the way, pregnancy sucks. I was still sick every morning, and sometimes it was hard to make it to the bathroom in time. I'd read that some women never got sick at all, but not me. I'd barfed 49 mornings in a row, and I had the sense that my body seemed to be going for some kind of record. If there was a plus side to the barfing, it was that I hadn't gained much weight. Maybe only a pound or two by mid-November. And frankly, I didn't want to get fat. But my mom had bought me the book What to Expect When You're Expecting, and as I reluctantly thumbed through it one evening, I learned that a lot of women put on only a pound or two in the first trimester, which made me nothing special. After that, though, the average weight gain was about a pound a week, right up until delivery. When I did the math, which would add 27 more pounds to my smallish frame, I realized that my six-pack abs would probably be replaced by a keg. Not, of course, that I had six-pack abs in the first place. Even worse than the barfing were the crazy hormones, which in my case meant acne. No matter how much I cleaned my face, pimples erupted on my cheeks and forehead like constellations in the nighttime sky. Morgan, my perfect older sister, never had a pimple in her life, and when I stared in the mirror, I thought I could give her a dozen of mine and still have skin that looked worse than hers did. Even then, she'd probably still be beautiful, smart, and popular. We got along okay at home. We were closer when we were younger. But at school, she kept her distance, preferring the company of her own friends. She got straight A's, played the violin, and had appeared in not one but 2 television commercials for a local department store. If you think it was easy being compared to her while I was growing up, think again. Toss in my pregnancy, and it was pretty clear why she was far and away my parents' favorite. Frankly,
She would have been my favorite, too. By the time Thanksgiving rolled around, I was officially depressed. That occurs in approximately 7% of pregnancies, by the way. Between barfing, zits, and depression, I'd hit the trifecta. Lucky me, right? I was falling further behind in school, and the music on my Walkman grew noticeably gloomier. Even Gwen tried and failed to cheer me up. I'd gotten to know her a little since our first introduction. She came to dinner twice a week, and she'd asked me whether I wanted to watch the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade. She'd brought over a small television and set it up in the kitchen. But even though I'd practically forgotten what a TV looked like by then, it wasn't enough to entice me from my room. Instead, I sat alone and tried not to cry while imagining my mom and Morgan making stuffing or baking pies in the kitchen and my dad in the recliner, enjoying a football game. Even though my aunt and Gwen served a meal similar to what my family usually had, it just wasn't the same, and I barely had any appetite. I also thought a lot about my best friends, Madison and Jody. I hadn't been allowed to tell them the truth about why I'd left. Instead, my parents had told people, including Madison's and Jody's parents, that I'd gone to live with my aunt in some remote place because of an urgent medical situation with limited telephone availability. No doubt they'd made it sound like I volunteered to help Aunt Linda, being that I was such a responsible do-gooder. Lest the lie be discovered, however, I wasn't supposed to speak with my friends while I was gone. I had no cellular phone. Few kids did back then. And when my aunt went to work, she would bring the cord from the home phone with her, which I guess made the limited telephone availability part as true as the urgent medical situation part. My parents, I realized, could be just as sneaky as I, which was a revelation of sorts. It was around that time, I think, that my aunt began to worry about me, though she tried to downplay her concerns. As we were eating Thanksgiving leftovers, she casually mentioned that I hadn't seemed particularly chipper lately. That was the word she used. Chipper. She'd also eased up a little on the tidiness thing. Or maybe I was doing a better job of cleaning. But for whatever reason, she hadn't been complaining as much recently. I could tell she was making an effort to engage me in conversation.
Are you taking your prenatal vitamin?
Yes, I answered. It's yummy.
In a couple of weeks, you'll see the OBGYN in Moorhead City. I set up the appointment this morning.
Swell, I said. I moved the food around my plate, hoping she wouldn't notice that I wasn't really eating.
The food has to actually go in your mouth, she said. And then you have to swallow it.
I think she was trying to be funny, but I wasn't in the mood. So I simply shrugged.
Can I make you something else?
I'm not that hungry. She brought her lips together before scanning the room as if searching for magic words that would make me chipper again.
Oh, I almost forgot to ask. Did you call your parents?
No. I was going to call them earlier, but you took the phone cord with you.
You could call them after dinner.
I guess. She used her fork to cut a bite of turkey.
How are your studies going?
She asked.
You're behind in your homework, and you haven't been doing that well on your quizzes lately.
I'm trying, I answered, even though I really wasn't.
How about math? Remember that you have some pretty big tests coming up before Christmas break.
I hate math, and geometry is stupid. Why does it matter whether I know how to measure the area of a trapezoid? It's not like I'm ever going to need to use that in my real life. I heard her sigh, watched her cast about again.
Did you write your history paper? I think that's also due next week.
It's almost done, I lied. I'd been assigned to do a report on Thurgood Marshall, but I hadn't even started it. I could feel her eyes on me, wondering whether to believe me. Later that night, she tried again. I was lying in bed with Maggie Bear. I'd retreated to my room after dinner, and she was standing in the doorway dressed in her pajamas.
Have you thought about getting some fresh air?
My aunt asked.
Like maybe going for a walk or a bike ride before you start doing your homework tomorrow.
There isn't anywhere to go. Almost everything is closed for the winter.
How about the beach? It's peaceful this time of year.
It's too cold to go to the beach.
How would you know? You haven't been outside in days.
That's because I have too much homework and too many chores.
Have you thought about trying to meet someone closer to your own age? Maybe make some friends?
At first, I wasn't sure I'd heard her right. Make friends?
Why not?
Because no one my age lives here.
Of course they do,
she said.
I showed you the school.
The village had a single school that served children from kindergarten through high school. We'd ridden past it during the tour of the island. It wasn't quite the single-room schoolhouse I'd seen in reruns of Little House on the Prairie, but it wasn't much more than that either. I guess I could head to the boardwalk, or maybe hit the clubs. Oh, wait. Ocracoke doesn't have either of those things.
I'm just saying that it might be good for you to talk to someone besides me or Gwen. It's not healthy to stay so isolated.
No doubt about it. But the simple fact was that I hadn't seen a single teenager in Ocracoke since I had arrived. And, oh yeah, I was pregnant, which was supposed to be a secret. So what would be the point anyway? Being here isn't good for me either, but no one seems to care about that. She adjusted her pajamas as though searching for words in the fabric and decided to change the subject.
I've been thinking that it might be a good idea to get you a tutor,
she said.
Definitely for geometry, but maybe for your other classes too. To review your paper, for instance.
A tutor?
I believe I know someone who'd be perfect.
I suddenly had visions of sitting beside some ancient geezer who smelled of Old Spice and mothballs and liked to talk about the good old days. I don't want a tutor.
Your finals are in January, and there are multiple exams in the next 3 weeks, including some big ones. I promised your parents that I'd do my best to make sure you don't have to repeat your sophomore year.
I hated when adults did the logic and guilt thing, so I retreated into the obvious. Whatever. She raised an eyebrow, remaining silent. Then finally,
don't forget that we have church on Sunday.
How could I forget that? I remember, I finally muttered.
Perhaps we could pick out a Christmas tree afterward.
Super, I said. But all I really wanted was to pull the covers over my head in the hope of making her leave. But it wasn't necessary. Aunt Linda turned away. A moment later, I heard her bedroom door close, and I knew that I'd be alone the rest of the night, with only my own dark thoughts to keep me company. As miserable as the rest of the week was, Sundays were the absolute worst. Back in Seattle, I didn't really mind going to church because there was a family there named the Taylors with four boys, all of them from one to a few years older than me. They were boy band perfect, with white teeth and hair that always looked blow-dried. Like us, they sat in the front row. They were always on the left while we were always on the right. And I'd sneak peeks at them even when I was supposed to be praying. I couldn't help it. I'd had a massive crush on one or the other pretty much as long as I could remember, even though I never actually spoke to any of them. Morgan had better luck. Danny Taylor, one of the middle ones, who at the time was also a pretty good soccer player, took her out for ice cream one Sunday after church. I was in the 8th grade at the time and desperately jealous that he'd asked her, not me. I remember sitting in my room and staring at the clock, watching the minutes pass. When Morgan finally got home, I begged her to tell me what Danny was like. Morgan, being Morgan, simply shrugged and said that he wasn't her type, which made me want to strangle her. Morgan had guys practically drooling if she so much as walked down the sidewalk or sipped a Diet Coke in the food court at the local mall. The point is, back home, there was something interesting to see at church. More specifically, four very cute somethings.
and that made the hour pass quickly. Here, though, church was not only a chore but an all-day event. There was no Catholic church in Ocracoke. The nearest one was St. Egbert's in Morehead City, and that meant catching the ferry at 7 in the morning. The ferry generally took 2.5 hours to reach Cedar Island, and from there it was another 40 minutes to the church itself. The service was at 11, which meant we had to wait yet another hour for it to begin, and the Mass lasted until noon. If that wasn't bad enough, the ferry back to Ocracoke didn't leave until 4 in the afternoon, which meant killing even more time. Oh, we'd have lunch with Gwen afterward, since she always came with us. Like my aunt, she also used to be a nun, and she considered attending services on Sundays the highlight of her week. She was nice and all, but ask any teenager how much they enjoy eating lunch with a couple of 50-odd-year-old former nuns, and you can probably guess what it was like. After that, we'd go shopping. But it wasn't fun shopping like at the mall or at the Seattle waterfront. Instead, they'd drag me to Walmart for supplies. Think flour, shortening, eggs, bacon, sausage, cheese, buttermilk, various flavored coffees, and other baking stuff in bulk. And after that, we'd visit garage sales, where they would search for inexpensive books by best-selling authors and movies on video cassette that they could rent to people on Ocracoke. Added to the late afternoon ferry ride, all of that meant that we wouldn't get back to the house until almost 7, when the sun had long since set. 12 hours. 12 long hours, just so we could go to church. There are, by the way, about 1 million better ways to spend a Sunday, but lo and behold, as Sunday morning dawned, I found myself standing at the dock in a jacket zipped to my chin, stamping one foot and then the other while the frigid air made it appear as though I were smoking invisible cigarettes. Meanwhile, my aunt and Gwen were whispering to each other and laughing and looking happy, probably because they weren't slinging biscuits and serving coffee before the crack of dawn. When it was time, my aunt pulled her car onto the ferry, where it crammed alongside about 12 others. I wish I could say that the ride was either pleasant or interesting, but it wasn't, especially in winter. Unless you enjoyed staring at gray skies and even grayer water, there was nothing to see. And if the dock had been freezing, riding on the ferry was 50 times worse. The wind seemed to blow right through me, and after less than 5 minutes outside, my nose started running and my ears turned bright red. There was, thank God, a large central cabin on the ferry where you could escape the weather, complete with a couple of vending machines offering snacks and places to sit, which is where Gwen and my aunt hung out. As for me, I crawled into the car and stretched out on the back seat, wishing I were anywhere else, and thinking about the mess I'd gotten myself into. The day after my mom had me pee on a stick, she brought me to see Dr. Bobby, who was maybe 10 years older than my mom, and the first non-pediatrician I'd ever seen. Dr. Bobby's real name was Roberta, and she was an OBGYN. She delivered both my sister and me, so she and my mom went way back, and I'm pretty sure my mom was mortified by the reason for our visit. After Dr. Bobby confirmed the pregnancy, she set me up with an ultrasound to make sure the baby was healthy. I pulled up my shirt. One of the technicians put some goop on my tummy, and I was able to hear the heartbeat. It was both cool and utterly terrifying. But what I remember most was how surreal it felt, and how much I wished that all of it was just a bad dream. But it wasn't a dream. Because I was Catholic, abortion wasn't even an option. And once we learned the baby was healthy, Dr. Bobby gave us the talk. She assured both of us that I was more than mature enough physically to carry the baby to term, but emotions were a different story. She said I was going to need a lot of support, partly because the pregnancy was unexpected, but mainly because I was still a teenager. In addition to feeling depressed, I might feel angry and disappointed as well.
Dr. Bobby warned that I was also likely to feel alienated from friends, making everything harder. Had I been able to check in with Dr. Bobby now, I would have told her check, 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 and check. With the talk ringing in her ears, my mom brought me to a support group for pregnant teenagers in Portland, Oregon. I'm sure there were the same kids of support groups in Seattle, but I didn't want anyone I knew to accidentally find out. And my parents didn't want that either. So after almost 3 hours in the car, I found myself in a back room at a YMCA where I sat in one of the fold-out chairs that had been arranged in a circle. There were 9 other girls there, and some of them looked like they were attempting to smuggle watermelons by hiding them under their shirts. The lady in charge, Mrs. Walker, was a social worker, and one by one we introduced ourselves. After that, we were all supposed to talk about our feelings and our experiences. What actually happened was that the other girls talked about their feelings and experiences while I simply listened. Really, it was just about the most depressing thing ever. One of the girls, who was even younger than me, talked about how bad her hemorrhoids had gotten, while another one droned on about how sore her nipples were before lifting her shirt to show us her stretch marks. Most, but not all of them, continued to attend their various high schools. And they talked about how embarrassed they were when they had to ask their teacher for a hall pass to go to the bathroom, sometimes 2 or 3 times during the same class period. All of them complained how their acne had gotten worse. 2 of them had dropped out. And though both said they planned to go back to school, I'm not sure anyone believed them. All had lost friends, and another had been kicked out of her house and was living with her grandparents. Only one of them, a pretty Mexican girl named Sarita, still spoke with the father of the child. Aside from her, none intended to marry. Except for me, all of them planned to raise their babies with the help of their parents. When it was over, as we were walking toward the car, I told my mom that I never wanted to do something like that again. It was supposed to be helpful and make me feel less alone, but it left me feeling exactly the opposite. What I wanted was to simply get through this so I could return to the life I had before, which was the same thing my parents wanted. That, of course, led them to making the decision to send me here. And though they assured me that it was for my own good, not theirs, I wasn't sure I believed them. After church, Aunt Linda and Gwen dragged me through the lunch shop for supplies garage sales routine before heading to a graveled lot near a hardware store, which held so many Christmas trees for sale that it resembled a miniature forest. My aunt and Gwen tried to make the experience fun for me and kept asking my opinion. For my part, I did a lot of shrugging and told them to pick whatever they wanted, since no one seemed to care what I thought anyway, at least when it came to decisions about my life. Somewhere around the 6th or 7th tree, Aunt Linda stopped asking, and they eventually made the selection without me. Once it was paid for, I watched as 2 guys wearing overalls tied the tree to the roof of the car, and we climbed back in. For whatever reason, the ride back to the ferry reminded me of the ride to the airport on my last morning in Seattle. Both my mom and my dad had seen me off, which was kind of a surprise, since my dad had barely been able to look at me since he'd learned I was pregnant. They walked me to the gate and waited with me until it was time to board. Both of them were really quiet, and I wasn't saying much either. But as time inched forward toward the departure, I remember telling my mom that I was afraid. In truth, I was terrified to the point that my hands had begun to shake. There were a lot of people around us, and she must have noticed the trembling because she took my hands and squeezed them. Then she led me to a less crowded gate, where we could have some privacy. "I'm afraid too."
"Why are you afraid?" I asked.
"Because you're my daughter. All I do is worry about you, and what happened is unfortunate."
Unfortunate. She'd been using that word a lot lately. Next, she'd remind me that leaving was for my own good. "I don't want to go," I said.
"We've talked about this," she said. "You know it's for your own good."
Bingo. "I don't want to leave my friends." By that point, it was all I could do to choke out the words. What if Aunt Linda hates me? What if I get sick and I have to go to the hospital? They don't even have a hospital there.
Your friends will still be here when you get back, she assured me. And I know it seems like a long time, but May will come more quickly than you realize. As for Linda, she used to help pregnant girls just like you when she was at the convent. You remember when I told you that? She'll take care of you. I promise.
I don't even know her.
She has a good heart, my mom said, or you wouldn't be going there. As for the hospital, she'll know what to do. But even in the worst-case scenario, her friend Gwen is a trained midwife. She's delivered lots of babies.
I wasn't sure that that made me feel any better. What if I hate it there?
How bad can it be?
It's right on the beach.
And besides, you remember our discussion, right? That it might be easier in the short run if you stay, but in the long run, it will surely make things harder for you.
She meant gossip. Not only about me, but about my family as well. It might not be the 1950s, but there was still a stigma attached to unwed teenage pregnancies. And even I had to admit that 16 was way too young to be a mom. If word got out, I would always be that girl to neighbors, other students at school, the people at church. To them, I'd always be that girl who got knocked up after her freshman year. I would have to endure their judgmental stares and condescension. I'd have to ignore their whispers as I walked past them in the hallways. The rumor mill would churn with questions about who adopted the baby, about whether I ever wanted to see the child again. Though they might not say it to me, they would wonder why I hadn't bothered to use birth control or insist that he wear a condom. I knew that many parents, including friends of the family, would use me as an example to their own children. As that girl. The one who'd made poor decisions. And all this while waddling the school hallways and having to pee every 10 minutes. Oh yeah, my parents had spoken with me about all of it more than a few times. My mom could tell, though, that I didn't want to revisit it, so she changed the subject. She did that a lot when she didn't want to argue, especially when we were in public.
Did you enjoy your birthday?
It was okay.
Just okay?
I barfed all morning. It was kind of hard for me to get excited. My mom brought her hands together.
I'm still glad you had a chance to visit with your friends.
Because it's the last time you'll see them for a long, long time. She didn't have to add. I can't believe I'm not going to be home for Christmas.
I'm sure Aunt Linda will make it special.
It still won't be the same, I whined.
No, my mom admitted. It probably won't be. But we'll have a nice visit when I see you in January.
Will Daddy come?
She swallowed.
Maybe, she said. Which also means maybe not, I thought. I'd heard them talking about it, but my dad hadn't committed to anything. If he could barely look at me now, how would he feel when I was doing my best to impersonate a female Buddha? I wish I didn't have to go.
Me too, she said. Do you want to visit with your dad for a while?
Shouldn't you be asking him if he wants to visit with me? But again, I kept quiet. I mean, what's the point? It's okay, I said. When I trailed off, my mom offered a sympathetic expression. And strangely, despite the fact that she and my dad were shipping me off, I had the sense she actually felt bad about it.
I know there's nothing easy about any of this, she whispered.
Surprising me, she reached into her purse and handed me an envelope. It was filled with cash, and I wondered whether my dad knew what she was doing. It's not as though my family had extra money lying around, but she didn't try to explain. Instead, we sat together for another few minutes until we heard the boarding announcement. When it was my turn, both my parents hugged me. But even then, my father glanced away. That was almost a month ago, but it already felt like a different life entirely. It wasn't nearly as cold on the ferry back as it had been in the morning.
The gray skies had given way to an almost shiny blue. I'd chosen to stay in the car for a while, despite the fact that the supplies we'd picked up made stretching out on the back seat impossible. I was trying to play the martyr, as neither Aunt Linda nor Gwen seemed to understand that Christmas tree shopping notwithstanding, Sundays were still the worst.
"Suit yourself,"
my aunt had said with a shrug after I'd declined their offer to join them in the cabin. She and Gwen had hopped out of the car, climbed the steps that led to the upper level, and quickly vanished from sight. Somehow, even though I was uncomfortable, I was able to fall asleep, finally waking after an hour. Turning on my Walkman, I listened to music for another hour until my batteries finally went dead, and the sky turned black. And after that, it wasn't long before I grew cramped and bored. Through the window beneath the glowing fairy lights, I could see a few older men congregated outside their cars, looking exactly like the fishermen they probably were. Like my aunt and Gwen, they eventually made their way to the cabin. I shifted in the seat and realized that nature was calling. Again. For the sixth or seventh time that day, even though I'd barely had anything to drink, I've forgotten to mention that my bladder had suddenly transformed from something I hardly ever thought about into a hypersensitive and highly inconvenient organ, one that made knowing exactly where to find a bathroom imperative at all times. Without warning, the cells in my bladder would suddenly start vibrating hysterically with the message, "You've got to empty me right this very second or else." And I'd learned that I didn't have a choice in the matter. Or else. If Shakespeare had tried to describe the urgency of the situation, he probably would have written to pee or not to pee. That is never the question. I scrambled out of the car, hurried up the steps and into the cabin where I vaguely noticed my aunt and Gwen chatting with someone at one of the booths. I quickly found the bathroom. Thankfully, it was unoccupied. And on my way back out, Aunt Linda motioned for me to join them. Instead, I ducked my head and exited the cabin. The last thing I wanted was another conversation with adults. My first instinct after descending the steps was to head back to the car. But the martyrdom wasn't working, and the batteries in my Walkman had died, so what was the point? Instead, I decided to explore, thinking it would kill some time. I figured I had probably half an hour to go until the ferry docked. I could already see the lights of Ocracoke in the distance. But unfortunately, the tour wasn't much more interesting than the Pamlico Sound. There was the aforementioned cabin in the center, cars parked on the deck below, and what I guessed was the control room where the captain sat above the cabin, which was off-limits. I did notice, however, a few empty benches toward the front of the boat, and with nothing better to do, I made my way there. It didn't take long to figure out why they were empty. The air was icy, the wind felt like it was stabbing my skin with little needles, and even though I buried my hands in the pockets of my jacket, I could still feel them tingling. On either side, I noticed small breakers in the dark ocean water, little flashes that seemed to sparkle. But the sight of those tiny waves made me think about him, even though I didn't want to. Jay. The boy who got me into this mess. What can I tell you about him? He was a 17-year-old surfer from Southern California with beachy good looks. He'd spent the summer in Seattle with a cousin who happened to be a friend of one of my friends. I first saw him at a little get-together in late June. But don't start thinking it was one of those kinds of parties with absent parents and rivers of booze and marijuana smoke drifting from beneath bedroom doors. My parents would have killed me. It wasn't even at a house. It was at Lake Sammamish, and my friend Jody was a friend of the cousin who brought Jay along. Jody convinced me to go, even though I wasn't sure I wanted to. But once I arrived, it took me all of about 2 seconds to notice him. He had longish blonde hair, broad shoulders, and a deep tan, which was almost impossible for me to attain. My skin preferred to mimic a bright red apple when exposed to the sun. Even from a distance, I could see every single muscle in his stomach, like he was some sort of living human anatomy display. He was also hanging out with Chloe,
a senior from one of the public high schools I vaguely recognized but didn't know, who was equally gorgeous. It was clear they were together. Nancy Drew that I was, I couldn't help but notice, since they were making out and basically hanging all over each other. Even so, that didn't stop me from checking him out as I sat on my towel the rest of the afternoon, in much the same way I ogled the Taylor boys at church. I admit I'd gone a little boy crazy in recent years. It should have ended there, but strangely it didn't. Because of Jody. I saw him on the 4th of July. That one was a nighttime party because of the fireworks. But there were a lot of parents there. And then again a couple of weeks later at the mall. Each time he was with Chloe, and he didn't seem to notice me at all. Then came Saturday, August 19th. What can I say? I'd just seen Die Hard with a vengeance with Jody, even though I'd already seen it once before, and afterward we went to her house. This time her parents weren't home. The cousin was there, along with Jay. But Chloe wasn't. Somehow Jay and I ended up talking on the back porch. And miraculously, he seemed interested in me. He was also friendlier than I'd expected. He told me about California, asked me about my life in Seattle, and he finally mentioned in passing that he and Chloe had broken up. Not long after that, he kissed me, and he was so gorgeous, things just cut away from me. Long story short, I ended up in the back seat of his cousin's car. I didn't set out to have sex with him, but probably, like everyone my age, I was curious about the whole thing, you know? I wanted to know what the big deal was. Nor did he force me. Just kind of happened. And the whole thing was over in less than 5 minutes. Afterward, he was nice about it. When I had to leave to meet my 11 p.m. curfew, he walked me to the car and kissed me again. He promised to call me, but he didn't. 3 days later, I saw him with his arm around Chloe, and when they kissed, I turned around before he could see me, my throat feeling as though I'd swallowed sandpaper. Later, when I learned I was pregnant, I called him in California. Jody got his number from the cousin since Jay hadn't given it to me, and when I told him who I was, he didn't seem to remember me. It was only when I reminded him about what happened that he recalled our time together. But even then, I had the sense that he didn't have the slightest clue what we'd talked about, or even what I looked like. He also asked why I was calling with a kind of irritated tone, and you didn't need a perfect SAT score to know he had no interest in me at all. Though I'd intended to tell him that I was pregnant, I hung up the phone before the words could come out. And I've never spoken to him again. My parents know none of this, by the way. I refused to tell them anything about the father, or how nice he'd seemed at first, or even that he'd forgotten me entirely. It wouldn't have changed anything. And by then I already knew I'd be giving the baby up for adoption. You know what else I haven't told them? That after that phone call with Jay, I felt stupid. And as disappointed and angry as my parents were with me, I felt even worse about myself. While I was seated on the bench, with the ears already red and my nose beginning to run, I saw a flash of movement from the corner of my eye. Turning, I spotted a dog trotting by with a Snickers wrapper in its mouth. It looked almost exactly like Sandy, my dog back home, only a little bit smaller. Sandy was a cross between a golden and a Labrador retriever, with a tail that never seemed to stop wagging. Her eyes were a soft, dark caramel, full of expression. Had Sandy tried to play poker, she would have lost all her money because she couldn't bluff. I could always tell exactly what she was feeling. If I praised her, her gentle eyes would shine with happiness. If I was upset, they were full of sympathy. She'd been in our family for 9 years. We got her when I was in the first grade. And for most of her life, she'd slept at the foot of my bed. Now, she usually slept in the living room, because her hips weren't so good, and the stairs were hard for her. but even though she was getting white in the muzzle, her eyes hadn't changed at all. They were still as sweet as ever, especially when I cradled her furry head in my hands. I wondered if she would remember me when I moved back home. Silly, of course. There was no way that Sandy would forget me. She would always love me. Right? Right? Homesickness made my eyes moisten and I swiped at them. But then my hormones surged again, insisting that I missed Sandy so much. Without thinking, I rose from the bench. I saw imitation Sandy trotting toward a guy seated near the edge of the deck in a lawn chair, his legs stretched out in front of him. He wore an olive-green jacket, and beside him, I noticed, was a camera mounted on a tripod. I stopped. As much as I wanted to see, and yes, pet the dog, I wasn't sure whether I wanted to engage in stilted conversation with the owner, especially once he noticed I'd been crying. I was about to turn away when the guy whispered something to the dog. I watched as the dog turned and trotted to a nearby garbage can, where it popped onto its rear legs and carefully deposited the Snickers wrapper. I blinked, thinking, wow, that's kind of cool. The dog returned to the guy's side, settled, and was just about to close its eyes when the man dropped an empty paper cup onto the deck. The dog quickly rose, grabbed the cup, and put it into the garbage before returning. When another cup was dropped about a minute later, I couldn't help myself. "What are you doing?" I finally asked. The man turned in his seat, and it was only then that I realized my mistake. He wasn't a man, but rather a teenager, maybe a year or two older than I was, with hair the color of chocolate and dark eyes flickering with amusement. His jacket, made out of olive-colored canvas with intricate stitching, was strangely stylish, especially for this part of the world. When he raised an eyebrow, I had the uneasy feeling that he'd been expecting me. In the silence, I felt a burst of surprise at the thought that my aunt had been right. There actually was someone my age around here, or at the very least, someone my age who was on his way to Ocracoke. The island wasn't entirely composed of fishermen and former nuns or older women who ate biscuits and read romance novels. The dog, too, seemed to evaluate me. Its ears perked up and it wagged its tail hard enough to thump the guy's leg. But unlike Sandy, who loved everyone immediately and intensely and would have trotted over to greet me, this dog turned its attention back to the cup, quickly repeating its earlier performance, once more putting it into the garbage can. Meanwhile, the guy continued to watch me. Even though he was seated, I could tell he was lean, muscular, and definitely cute. But my whole boy crazy face had pretty much died the moment Dr. Bobby spread that goop on my tummy, and I heard the heartbeat. I let my gaze fall, wishing that I'd just gone back to the car and regretting I'd said anything at all. I'd never been good at eye contact, except at slumber parties when I was having a staring contest with my friends. And the last thing I needed was another boy in my life. Especially on a day like today. Not only had I been crying, but I hadn't worn any makeup, and I was dressed in baggy jeans, Converse high tops, and a down jacket that probably made me look like the Stay Puffed Marshmallow Man. "Hi," he finally ventured, breaking into my thoughts. "I'm just enjoying the fresh air." I didn't answer. Instead, I continued to focus on the water, pretending that I hadn't heard him and hoping he wouldn't ask if I'd been crying. "Are you okay? You look like you've been crying." "Great," I thought. Even though I didn't want to talk to him, I didn't want him to think I was an emotional wreck either. "I'm fine," I asserted. I was at the front of the boat, and the wind made my eyes water. I wasn't sure he believed me, but he was nice enough to act like he did. "It's pretty up there." "There's not much to see once the sun goes down." "You're right," he agreed. "The whole ride has been pretty quiet so far. No reason to even reach for the camera."
I'm Bryce Trickett, by the way.
His voice was soft and melodic. Not that I cared one way or the other. Meanwhile, the dog had begun to stare at me, its tail thumpy, which reminded me of the reason I'd spoken up in the first place. Did you train your dog to throw out garbage?
I'm trying to, he said before breaking into a smile, dimples flashing. But she's young and still working on it. She ran off a few minutes ago, so we had to practice again.
My attention was fixed on those dimples, and it took me a second to retrieve my train of thought. Why?
Why what?
Why train your dog to throw out the garbage?
I don't like litter, and I didn't want any of it blowing into the ocean. It's not good for the environment.
I meant, why don't you just throw it out?
Because I was sitting down?
That's mean.
Sometimes the mean justifies the end, right?
Ha ha, I thought. But actually, I'd walked right into a stupid pun, grudgingly acknowledging that it was kind of original as far as puns went.
Besides, Daisy doesn't mind,
he went on.
She thinks it's a game. Do you want to meet her?
Even before I could respond, he said, break. And Daisy quickly rose to her feet. Walking over, she curled around my legs, whining, her tongue lapping at my fingers. Not only did she look like Sandy, she felt like her. And while I stroked her fur, I was transported back to a simpler, happier life in Seattle, before everything went sour. But just as quickly, reality came rushing back and I realized that I had no desire to linger. I offered Daisy a couple of final pats and put my hands in my pockets while trying to think of an excuse to leave. Bryce was not deterred.
I don't think I caught your name.
I didn't tell you my name.
That's true,
he said.
But I can probably figure it out.
You think you can guess my name?
I'm usually pretty good, he said. I can read palms, too.
Are you serious?
Would you like a demonstration?
Before I could answer, he gracefully rose from his chair and started toward me. He was a little taller than I'd expected, and lanky, like a basketball player. Not a center or forward like Zeke Watkins, but maybe a shooting guard. When he was close, I could see flecks of hazel in his brown eyes, and again I noticed the trace of amusement in his expression that I'd seen earlier. He seemed to scan my face, and when he was satisfied, he motioned to my hands, which were still buried in my pockets.
Can I see your hands now? Just hold them face up.
It's cold.
It won't take long.
This was weird and getting weirder, but whatever. After I showed him my palms, he leaned closer to them, concentrating. He held a finger up.
Do you mind?
He asked. Go ahead. He traced his finger lightly over the lines in my palms, one after the other. It struck me as strangely intimate, and I felt a little unsettled.
You're definitely not from Ocracoke,
he intoned. Wow, I said, trying to keep him from knowing how I felt. Amazing, and your guess probably has nothing to do with the fact that you've never seen me around here before.
I meant that you're not from North Carolina. You're not even from the South.
You might have also noticed I don't have a Southern accent. Nor did he, I suddenly realized, which was strange since I thought everyone in the South was supposed to sound like Andy Griffith. He continued to trace for another few seconds before pulling his finger back.
Okay, I think I've got it now. You can put your hands back in your pockets.
I did. I waited, but he said nothing. And?
And what?
Do you have all your answers?
Not all of them, but enough. I'm pretty sure I know your name.
No, you don't.
If you say so.
Whether he was cute or not, I was done with the game and it was time for me to go. I think I'm going to sit in the car for a while, I said. It's getting cold. Nice meeting you. Turning around, I took a couple of steps before I heard him clear his throat.
"You're from the West Coast,"
he called out.
"But not California. I'm thinking Washington, maybe Seattle."
His words stopped me in my tracks, and when I turned, I knew I couldn't hide my shock.
"I'm right, aren't I?"
"How did you know?"
"The same way I know you're 16 and a sophomore. You've also got an older sibling, and I'm guessing it's a sister.
And her name starts with an M. Not Molly or Mary or Marie, but something even more formal, like Margaret. Only you probably call yourself Maggie or something like that."
I felt my jaw drop slightly, too stunned to say anything at all.
"And you didn't move to Ocracoke permanently. You're only staying a few months or so, right?"
He shook his head, breaking into that smile again.
"But enough. Like I said earlier, I'm Bryce, and it's nice to meet you, Maggie."
It took a few seconds before I was finally able to croak out, "You could tell all that from looking at my face and my palms?"
"No, I learned most of it from Linda."
It took me a second to figure it out.
"My aunt?"
"I visited her for a little while when I was in the cabin. She pointed you out when you walked past our table and she told me a little about you. I'm the one who fixed your bike, by the way."
As I peered at him, I vaguely remembered my aunt and Gwen talking to someone in the booth.
"Then what was all that stuff about my face and my palms?"
"Nothing. Just having fun."
"That wasn't very nice."
"Maybe not, but you should have seen your expression. You're very pretty when you have no idea what to say."
I almost wasn't sure I'd heard him right. "Pretty? Did he just say that I'm very pretty?" Again, I reminded myself that it didn't matter one way or the other. I could have done without the magic trick.
"You're right. It won't happen again."
"Why would my aunt tell you about me?" And I wondered what else she had told him.
"She wanted to know if I was interested in tutoring you. I do that sometimes."
"You've got to be kidding me. You're going to be my tutor?"
"I haven't committed to it. I wanted to meet you first."
"I don't need a tutor."
"My mistake, then."
"My aunt just worries a lot."
"I understand."
"Then why doesn't it sound like you believe me?"
"I have no idea. I was just going on what your aunt told me. But if you don't need a tutor, that's fine with me."
His grin was relaxed, his temples still in place.
"How do you like it so far?"
"Like what?"
"Ocracoke," he said. "You've been here a few weeks now, right?"
"It's kind of small."
"For sure,"
he laughed.
"It took me a while to get used to it, too."
"You weren't raised here?"
"No,"
he said.
"Like you, I'm a dingbatter."
"What's a dingbatter?"
"Anyone who isn't originally from here."
"That's not a real thing."
"It is around here,"
he said.
"My father and my brothers are dingbatters, too. Not my mom, though. She was born and raised here. We've only been back for a few years."
He hooked a thumb over his shoulder toward an older model truck with fading red paint and large, wide tires.
"I've got an extra chair in the car if you want to sit. It's a lot more comfortable than the benches."
"I should probably get going. I don't want to bother you."
"You're not bothering me at all. Until you showed up, the ride was fairly boring."
I couldn't exactly tell if he was flirting, but uncertain, I said nothing at all. Bryce seemed to take my lack of an answer as a yes and went on.
"Great," he said. "I'll get the chair."
Before I knew what was happening, the chair was angled toward the ocean beside his, and I watched as he took a seat. Suddenly feeling a bit trapped, I made my way toward the other chair and seated myself gingerly alongside him. He stretched his legs out in front of him.
"Better than the bench, right?"
I was still trying to digest how good-looking he was, and that my aunt, the former nun, had set all this up. or maybe not. The last thing my parents probably wanted was for me to meet anyone of the opposite sex ever again, and they'd probably told her that too. I guess. It's still kind of cold. As I spoke, Daisy moseyed over and lay down between us. I reached toward her, giving her a quick pat.
"Be careful," he said. "Once you start petting her, she can get kind of insistent that you never stop."
"It's okay. She reminds me of my dog. Back home, I mean."
"Yeah?"
"Sandy's older and a little bigger, though. I miss her." "How old is Daisy?"